In the famous tale of the emperor's new clothes, you'll recall, all the high officials at court and all the leading men of the land agreed to pretend that the emperor was sumptuously arrayed. Only one little boy told the truth. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, David Berlinski, mathematician, philosopher, and essayist, in one brilliant, elegant book after another, Dr. Berlinski has attacked global warming, Darwin, and other scientific pretensions, insisting that the emperor is naked. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson, a mathematician, philosopher, and essayist who has taught at institutions including Stanford, Rutgers, and the Université de Paris. David Berlinski is the author of books including The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, The Deniable Darwin, and the forthcoming, to be published next year, The Best of Times, which the author has been kind enough to give to me in galleys. David Berlinski, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Scientific Pretensions, from The Devil's Delusion, quote, "A great many men and women have a dull, hurt, angry sense of being oppressed by the sciences. Oppressed by the sciences. They're frustrated by endless scientific boasting. They suspect that the scientific community holds them in contempt. They are right to feel this way." Close quote. David, explain.
Don't you kind of think that one is obvious? I mean, when you run into any kind of group of scientists, I mean, not the low-level scientists, the bottom feeders, but physicists or mathematicians, they really don't waste any time telling you how much smarter they are than you. I mean, that's true. We all have that experience. And the global warming issue is one issue. The biological issue is another issue. But it's more than that. It's kind of this feeling that because they're so smart, and that's true, they are smart, no question about that, they have accepted as an obligation and as a pleasure the prerogative of telling the rest of us what to think, not only about the sciences, but about everything. And that is oppressive.
Well, we'll come to the 20th century in a moment, with the gruesome aspects of the 20th century, but there were some splendid aspects of the 20th century, including, for example, electric light, indoor plumbing, decrease in infant mortality, and wouldn't the scientific establishment say, we scientists, brought that to you. You owe us some deference. Science gets places. It enables lives to become better, more comfortable, healthier, more rewarding.
Well, do we really want to say that an immense amount of deference is due to the community of physicists for the invention of the indoor toilet? I don't know. That seems a stretch to me. I love the toilet as much as the next man. But it's a 19th century invention, not a 20th century invention. And it had very little to do with the sciences. It was a brilliant example of technology applied successfully. Also, electricity, lighting.
Penicillin. I've got you on that one, haven't I?
Terrific, terrific invention. Couldn't be better. Agreed. It's a great achievement. There's no question about it. But the issue is not this particular triumph. Look, I mean, quantum field theory is a great achievement, too. Mathematics in the 20th century is a profound achievement. The issue is the overall omnipotence, intellectual omnipotence, that is assumed by the scientific community.
Global warming. Now, as far as I know, you haven't written at length about the science of climate change, but you have written this, and I'm quoting here from a post you put up on Ricochet this past summer, quote, "Global warming, who knows? Not me for sure. But what I do know is that climate science is and has been in the hands of intellectual mediocrities and pious charlatans," close quote.
For sure. For sure. Not everyone. My buddy Dick Linson at MIT, who is a tremendous skeptic about global warming, is not a pious charlatan. But anyone who read those emails from East Anglia.
The leaked emails.
After you stopped chortling and really paid attention to what they're saying, their entire scientific position is, well, we've got a very weak theory. It's supported by so much gibberish in the computer record, let's just hide that from criticism and suppress those people who don't agree with us. That is the public posture on global warming. Now, that's changed. Mm-hmm. It has changed. There's a lot more subtlety in the issue now. And even the people who are most alarmed are willing to admit, well, you know, 15 years, it hasn't been much warming at all. In fact, there's been no warming. Maybe we should factor that in into our self-congratulation. That's a good thing. But the real issue is that global warming is an imponderable. Global warming may be increasing to dramatic and harmful extents, but we don't know that. The science isn't clear enough.
More from that Ricochet post of last August. Quote, what is so striking is the tendency of the scientific community both to an extravagant boastfulness, you've explained that, and to a barely concealed eagerness to help itself to an ever larger portion of the national wealth. Close quote. You wish to assert that some large component of the motivation among scientists to alarm us about global warming is their desire for federal funding.
All of it. Not just some large part, all of it. The amount of federal money going into global warming, climate research, is just staggering. It dwarfs the paltry contribution of the ever-zealous oil companies. I mean, there's a huge federal investment in this project. And it can't be stopped. It's ongoing. If you want to help yourself to some of the national wealth, affirm to the National Science Foundation or the National Institute for Energy or any of the federal agencies that you've got a red-hot proof that global warming is increasing, and you can go to the very best Parisian restaurants the next day. I guarantee it. This isn't just global warming.
Right.
This is across the board. Since the 1950s, the dominating motivation of the sciences is to help themselves to ever more swag. Now, I can sympathize. It's a human emotion. But let's not blind ourselves to the sheer facts. This is, as the budget increases, and has increased from 1950, say, to 2000, a dominating emotion in the biological sciences. 90% of the time is spent on grant renewals.
So while we're talking, I want to get in a moment to Darwin, where you're at least as outrageous and provocative.
Not at all. Very modest.
Very modest. But on this question of funding of the sciences, that is an artifact largely of the Cold War.
Yes.
Federal funding began pouring into universities during the Cold War because it was believed that on defense issues, space, all of this, we were in a competition for our very national life. Now, we hear over and over again that we ought to build down the Defense Department because the Cold War is over. We ought to bring troops home from Europe. Indeed, we have been bringing some troops home from Europe because the Cold War is over. No one says it's time to end the tight relationship, at this point, deeply symbiotic relationship between federal funding and research universities. Does David Berlinski say that?
Sure. I just said it. Let's end it now. But before we end it, there's a fundamental
question. I thought we were all supposed to believe in basic research. That's one of the
Not me. Not me. What good does it do? If some guy is maniacally determined to investigate the structure of the subatomic universe, Gesundheit, let him go do that. But why should the taxpayers be billed for a $16 billion superconducting collider in Texas? It was rejected. So instead, the money went to Switzerland for the Large Hadron Collider. But this is a question that's very rarely asked. The virtue of fundamental research can be defined intrinsically. It's important to some people. But the virtue of fundamental research in a democratic society, that's not a question that can be reserved to the scientific community. That's got to be a democratic question. And it never is.
Because when the federal government provides funding, it has engaged in coercion.
Of course.
It has it has taken money away from citizens. Therefore, the scientists bear in a democracy a particular burden of justifying the good they are doing.
That's for sure. And the justification is inevitably, invariably, ineluctably always the same. Boy, this stuff is interesting. Maybe to some people.
The deniable Darwin. Quote, Darwin conceived of evolution in terms of small variations among organisms, variations by which a process of accretion allow one species to change continuously into another. Life, however, is absolutely nothing like this. Close quote.
You know, the right way to think about Darwin's signal achievement to 1859, and it is an achievement, there's no question about it, is to say it's in the tradition of Newtonian mechanics, where the underlying structures of change are all continuous. They move seamlessly. You can't do Newtonian mechanics without the assumption of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
In certain respects, it was a natural assumption for Darwin to make. It was the next step. If this works for the orbits of the planets, the continuous motion around the sun, elliptical motion around the sun, well, something like that might well work for the changes in species. That was a dramatic idea in 1859. But the extent to which biology reveals sharply discontinuous processes and structures was not properly appreciated in the 19th century. I mean, speciation is still a hypothetical event. We have very few dramatic examples of the transmutation of species. It may be possible, but you know, it's also possible to transmute base metals into gold. It's just very expensive. It's not what happens ordinarily.
Mm. So, for example, again in the Deniable Darwin, you write about the Cambrian, the so-called Cambrian explosion.
Right.
The fossil record before the Cambrian era, I'll try not to get this wrong, I mean, to me the Paleolithic and the Cambrian, that's all, but we get a fossil record that's very thin before the Cambrian of 600 million years ago, and then the Cambrian comes along and suddenly there are a lot of species in those rocks and we don't see them gradually taking shape. The species appear fully formed and they exist. And then some of them become extinct, but we don't see them developing. We just see them as they are, as long as they exist. Correct?
Not entirely.
No,
correct.
Okay.
Close.
All right.
There is a very rich body of evidence about life forms before the Cambrian.
Oh, there is. All right, I was mistaken.
Ediacaran strata. The real puzzle, and it is a much deeper puzzle, is that they seem to be uncoordinated with what takes place in the Cambrian. We have one set of organisms before the Cambrian explosion. We have an entirely other set of organisms after the Cambrian explosions. And if you take a Cambrian structure and you move it back, you frog step it back in time, there comes a point where all the paleontologists can say is, well, there must be ghost lineages in the past, but we haven't put our hands on them. Long time to be putting your hands in the muck looking for those ghost lineages. A long time has passed.
And this is something, just I want to make sure that the intuition is correct here. This is something that actually ought to be accessible to nearly any layman, because we've all seen movies, American Werewolf in London, in which a human being changes into a werewolf and you actually see frame by frame the nails grow. You ought to see something like that. Albeit at a pace of...
You're really tempting me now.
but you ought to see some sort of transformation from one mode of existence to another. You ought to see, right? Isn't that what's missing?
Well, we do see profound transformations from infancy to adolescence to adulthood to old age and death. That is a completely unacknowledged example of a transmutation. We all take that for granted.
Right.
And that demands a profound explanation in its own right. But the transmutation across species lines, that's just been very difficult to see. We see small variations in species, things changing slightly. For example, the beak of the finch changes,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it seems to change cyclically. It gets bigger, fatter, more narrow. The thing has a snout, it doesn't have a snout, goes back to the way it was. We don't see the finch becoming an elephant, for example. Mm. All right, that's an extravagant analogy. But even in cases where we seem to see a record in the bones, in the stacked dead of the paleontological record, we really can't quite make sense. Take for example, the whale transition about which I've spoken a number of times. Yeah, the modern whale, big, fat, blubbery thing, swims in the ocean, seems to have derived from a land-dwelling animal about the size of a very large rodent. I mean, it changes all the time. I used to think it was about the size of a cow. Now it's been demoted in size. Well, we cannot, and we have the intermediate fossils.
We do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what we cannot figure out is how did that happen in the appropriate window of time, about 8 to 10 million years? One thing, we don't have a measure to tell us how many changes we should expect.
Mm.
And for another thing, when we try to compute the changes that would be required to take a 1954 Chevrolet and make of it a Nautilus-class submarine, we very quickly say, you know, thousands and thousands of changes. Well, is the whale any different? We don't know.
We don't know. Once again, the deniable Darwin. Time and again, biologists explain the survival of an organism by reference to its fitness, and the fitness of an organism by reference to its survival. Now, I want to make sure I understand what you're arguing there, because whereas what you just discussed requires deep knowledge of the fossil record, which neither I nor most laymen will ever attain, what you're arguing here, I believe, is something that anybody who ponders it for a moment ought to be able to see, which is to say that the fundamental statement of Darwinian, of the Darwinian concept, survival of the fittest, is purely tautological. There is no objective criterion by which we can see whether it actually works or not. That is, why has an organism survived? Because it's the fittest. How do you know it's the fittest? Because it survived. So in and of itself, the Darwinian conception doesn't convey as much. Well, it's not falsifiable at a minimum. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a very esoteric point. It was made as soon as Darwin published his work. The objection was raised that the fundamental idea, absent an identification of fitness in qualitative or quantitative terms, is vacuous. And everybody says to himself, yeah, that's right. That's not telling us a whole lot. It may be an important statement in other ways, but it's not telling us a whole lot, because if we don't know what fitness really comes to, a qualitative account of those properties that will allow an organism better to reproduce in the future, then to say survival is attributable to fitness and fitness is evidence of survival doesn't tell us a whole lot we didn't know before. Yeah, sure. Those organisms that survived, survived. Don't have to take biology 101 to know that.
Right. We hear a lot about the scientific consensus in support of global warming, but that is as nothing by comparison with the scientific consensus committed to a Darwinian understanding of the way life emerged and developed on Earth.
It's absolute.
It's absolute. So here you sit across from me and say, oh, yeah, well, the tautological aspect of it was noticed right away. In Darwin's own time, people pointed that out. We've known for decades now that the fossil record is not what you would expect. There are some serious conceptual
gaps.
Problems. There are gaps. So why is it that, well, I mean, all you have to do is look at the way every time you write an article, now that we have the internet, you're assailed. The comments are vicious. You're assailed as this, that. What? There's a level of commitment which is not rational. Is that right? Explain it.
Yeah, I think that's true. Look, a lot of what I write, there's a source of deep, indubitable enjoyment poking my finger in somebody's eye. I'm not going to deny that. And the biological community is so self-satisfied, so smug, so sure they have all the answers that somebody who comes along and gives them a poke in the eye, of course they're going to respond with a form of indignation that is almost rabid. That goes without saying. But the much deeper question, I think, is why has this story, and that's really all that it is, why has this story, from 1960 to the present, you know, there was a lot of skepticism about Darwin after he published and throughout the first part of the 20th century. Why has this story become so governing to so many people? Well, one answer is that with the decline of religious faith, with the decline of any belief in the possibility of religious experience, and that's a fact of our contemporary life outside the Islamic world, say, there's a great hunger for a creation story. And what better creation story could be afforded than the one told both by the physicist, Big Bang, who knows how that happened, Darwin, spontaneous emergence and development of life on Earth. No external, transcendental, spiritual creator required, none welcome. That's a powerful motivation. That's a powerful motivation.
Design. In the deniable Darwin, you quote the famous argument, 18th century English theologian William Paley, who said quite simply, if you see a watch, you know there was a watchmaker. That's what the argument comes to, and he used that metaphor. There it is, a very good watchmaker in your case. David Berlinski writes in The Deniable Darwin, quote, it is worth remarking that it is simply a fact that this old-fashioned argument is entirely compelling. We never attribute the existence of a complex artifact to chance. Close quote.
Do we?
Well, I mean, you...
We agree, you see?
Bill Clinton. I can quote Bill Clinton in favor of your own argument, which is Bill Clinton, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know it didn't get there by itself. Same argument.
Look, there's a level of skepticism that I think becomes self-defeating. If someone says, looking at a watch, I don't know, you know, sand mixed with water, action of the waves, we all understand right away, without the need for argument, without the need for argument, that's not plausible. I think any discussion of Darwin and biology has to begin with that acknowledgement that we have very powerful intuitions which have not in any way been overturned by biological research, that the plain facts in front of us suggest a level of complexity which we cannot yet define, agreed, that we find very difficult to attribute to the kind of processes that we see explained in Darwinian theory. Look, even Richard Dawkins says the same thing, and every biologist following Dawkins says the same thing. Living creatures give the appearance of design. Mm-hmm. Francis Crick says, oh, yeah, that's true. We've got to remember they're not really design. Why do we have to remember that? Maybe that's the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's a truth. That possibility is not acknowledged.
Again, in The Deniable Darwin, you tell the story. It's not a story. You give an account of the MIT physicist Murray Eden, who ran some calculations. He estimated that the number of proteins from which life might be constructed numbers 10 to the 50th power, a very big number. And the possible combinations of these proteins from which life might have arisen is 20 to the 250th power, which is a number so large as to be...
It's meaningless.
Incomprehensible. You write, quote, a number larger by far than the seconds in the history of the world since the Big Bang. And then you write this, quote, in some sense, evolution knew where it was going. What do you mean by that? Out of this incomprehensibly large possibility field, so to speak, there must be some mathematical way of describing this. Somehow or other, evolution didn't have time to experiment with all the chances.
That's for sure, isn't
right?
It? Isn't it? I mean, if we're looking at a space such astronomical size, 250th power, clearly we're not talking about any kind of random search through that space. When I made this point in Paris at a mathematics seminar, my friend René Thom, the mathematician, got up. He immediately became excited by the whole thing. He said, yes, we need a theory of canalization. And he wandered to the blackboard and he said, let's assume an n-dimensional abstract vector space. And canalization on the vector space, I lost. I didn't understand what he was saying. But the idea immediately is obvious that when we're dealing with this enormity, there has to be directed paths throughout the space. Now, to say that evolution knew where it was going assigns a degree of agency to evolution that I think is probably inappropriate for sophisticated people like us. But
it's a vivid metaphor. So let me quote you one more time from The Deniable Darwin. I want to move on to history, but one more on evolution. You quote the Bible. You quote the Hebrew Scriptures, David. God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let fowl fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. Close quote. And then you continue, and who on the basis of experience would be inclined to disagree with the biblical account. An active intelligence is required to bring even a thimble into being. Why should the artifacts of life be different? Out with it, David. Are you saying that there is an intelligent designer, a being, a God?
Does it seem to you that I was saying that?
Here's what I do. You come close and then you step back.
Exactly. Got to protect both flanks. It seems to me the intuitions of mankind should not be spurned or scorned carelessly. For sure, there's something sometimes wrong. Aristotle was wrong about physics. Our intuitions about moving objects are wrong. There's no question about it. It's not impetus that counts, but acceleration. But when it comes to living systems, we are among the living systems, and I think our intuitions about what's going on are far more profound than they are in the case of mathematical physics. I think the universal reaction, the default position of the human race is that some creative act was necessary to bring the panorama into existence. And I share that default position.
I have here, David, only the galleys that you were kind enough to send me, the best of times. So let's take a moment. The best of times will be published.
What you have is part one. There's part two and part three, which unaccountably remain to be written.
I see.
But
the best of times will be published when the book is written.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. But there's plenty to talk about in part one. You begin this book, this meditation on history and violence, the best of times, with the great Whig historian Thomas Babington Macaulay, who insisted that history was making progress, that it was going somewhere. And you quote Macaulay to this effect, quote, We rely on the natural tendency of the human intellect to truth and on the natural tendency of society to improvement, close quote. Why do you start with that?
Because Macaulay, writing in 1830, 1831, was expressing a very reasonable assumption about early 19th century society after the French Revolution, after the Congress of Vienna in 1815, that at least in England, we had finally come to a position where we could see all of the Enlightenment promises not fulfilled, but gathering force. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that in 1830, 1831. He extrapolated to the far future. He started talking about natural tendencies as if they were inexorable tendencies. And he gave a very, very eloquent defense of the idea that finally in 1830, after thousands of years of tumult and strife and violence, we have seen our way forward, just as the Enlightenment figures predicted we would see our way forward, to ever-increasing progress. This is a very powerful idea. Now, this idea did not really survive in the 20th century. After 1914, between 1914 and, to my way of thinking, to the present time, no one could talk about the natural tendencies of societies toward improvement or the natural tendencies of the intellect toward truth. That would just be absurd. Nonetheless, what is interesting is the idea has come back. And the idea is almost the default assumption of the scientific intellectual community. That's what I find so interesting.
Well, the idea, so here's what, you haven't written parts two and three, so.
They're even better.
I'm sure. Macaulay is writing, I'm testing this something out here, the thought is occurring to me as I speak, so I will misstate it. It will occur misshapen and I will misstate it, I'm sure. But Macaulay is writing, it occurs to me, not just when we begin to understand, well, you can gaslight. This is when the toilet begins to change sanitation in London and so forth. But he also feels, I think, a kind of unity of moral and material progress.
Oh, yes.
And that is not available to us, is it? After the First World War, after Nazism, after the Holocaust, after the killing fields in Cambodia, we're left with material or scientific progress alone. Nobody would argue that moral progress, that our moral life is getting anywhere. Isn't that right? And isn't that, in some ways, isn't that, doesn't that feed back into the scientific pretension? We're the only part of this civilization that's making progress, that's going anywhere, we scientists.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's absolutely true. But don't forget that the Whig interpretation of history, Macaulay's view of history as a progression. If you take away the specifics of Macaulay's view of English, the development of English history, English kingship, a lot of other things, and you just look at what I think is the profound idea that Enlightenment philosophy has given to skeptical and intelligent men and women the only set of tools they could possibly use to come to grips with the world. That is reason, rationality, a faith in progress, a doctrine of equality, and a variety of ancillary doctrines. Mm-hmm. Then you'll find that Macaulay very nicely expresses a kind of a opinion about the world that is astonishingly common. It's certainly the default position in the academic world in the United States.
Mm-hmm. It is true that every university in the country now is talking about solving the world's problems.
Oh, sure.
One phrase or another, one phrase like that or another is in every fundraising letter you will receive. Well, then you write about you write at some length about the First World War, which is the huge civilizational catastrophe.
Immolation of European civilization.
And throughout the 20th century, you write that of some 230 million victims of violence, slaughtered in the First World War, killed in the Holocaust, starved by Stalin and Mao, the killing fields in Cambodia, and on and on. And then you quote Hannah Arendt, "It is in the very nature of things, human, that every act that has once made its appearance and has been recorded in the history of mankind stays with mankind as a potentiality long after its actuality has become a thing of the past." Close quote. That's arresting enough. Here's what David Berlinski adds. I'm quoting you. "It is in this sense that the 20th century, having introduced into human history crimes never before imagined, is immortal. It is simply there, an obelisk in human history, black, forbidding, irremovable, and inexpungible." Close quote.
I think that's true. God help us, I think it's true.
When I read that, I thought to myself, I believe I understand how Germans of my generation feel. They can't get out from under their own history.
And they never will.
And what you're saying is none of us can get out from under their history or Soviet history.
Because we share an identity with humanity itself. To lose that would be to lose something of enormous importance. We cannot allow ourselves to forget what the 20th century really represented. And just as the crucifixion in Christian theology is beyond space and time, so the crimes of the 20th century are in a place of their own. They're not simply incidental acts of violence. They fundamentally change the way we should, not the way we do, but the way we should think about human history. To seriously look at the 20th century, the First World War, the Second World War, 60 million deaths, the Holocaust, the inconceivable project of exterminating European Jewry, the Great Terror, Mao's lunatic experiments with the Chinese people, to seriously look at all that. You cannot go back and read Macaulay. You just can't. I mean, you can read him, but you can't take him seriously anymore. And what I find so dismaying is that while I have that particular point of view to espouse, there are plenty of people who are going back to Macaulay who are saying the same thing. 20th century, well, you know, a lot of rotten things happen, but those are statistical anomalies. They happen from time to time. The First and Second World, well, one of those things that just happens. We should expect a big war every 10,000 years. We just happen to live through it. That, to my way of thinking, is simply insane.
You can't read Macaulay, but you argue, again in the best of times, that you can read St. Augustine. Quote, I'm quoting you now, "An analysis of the First World War adequate to its magnitude would require a work comparable to St. Augustine's City of God." Augustine's position, of course, is that he's Bishop of Hippo. He's in North Africa.
That's right.
As the barbaric, during the first sack of Rome, he witnesses this civilization of which he himself represents one of the greatest flowers.
Deeply immersed,
deeply educated in the classical works, and he sees across the Mediterranean a civilizational collapse. He's not in the position we're in of guessing at how much longer things will run. He lives through the sack of Rome. He sees it. All right. "Augustine could grasp events," I'm continuing to quote you, David, "only by a radical reinterpretation of human history. The categories to which he appealed are no longer available to historical analysis," close quote. In what ways did Augustine reinterpret history, and why can't we access his categories?
I think the precis, the summary you gave, was dead on, exactly right. Augustine watched a comparable catastrophe. I mean, don't forget, classical civilization lasted a whole lot longer than modern European civilization. And it was a magnificent achievement in statecraft, art, politics, science, and that it should just crumble before his eyes. You know, the dates are very interesting. 360, 370, 380, classical civilization, Roman civilization is still functioning. 30 years later.
Alaric invades and Saxon.
30 years later, there's a catastrophe. And Augustine played around with the idea that perhaps there was an explanation in terms of the violence and stupidity of the pagan past. And he actually commissioned someone to look into it. A very interesting book, title of which I forgot. And he came to the conclusion, this isn't right. The only explanation adequate, commensurate to the magnitude of events, cannot be historical, it has to be theological. It has to involve a limitation of our association with the city of man and a refocusing our attention on the city of God, and to see the interaction between the two as part of a divine plan. Now, you cannot in the 21st century argue that way anymore. You simply cannot. It's no longer part, for better or for worse, of our intellectual experience.
You cannot argue that way, and be taken seriously in faculty lounges.
That's right.
Isn't that what you mean?
Yes.
Didn't Benedict XVI argue just that way? I don't know what Pope Francis will argue. Aren't there wise men? Aren't there learned rabbis in Israel who insist on grounding?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But the point is, we do live in a society where the house of intellect is coordinated with only a finite number of microphones, and those microphones are connected with the academic world and with a certain part of the journalistic world. I think that's true in the United States, it's true in Canada, England, France, throughout Europe. There is a doctrine amounting to a dogma. And according to the doctrine and the dogma, this way of thinking, no matter what Benedict says or what the rabbis in Israel say, is not part of the interpretable canon. It cannot be introduced. Should it be introduced? Would it make more sense? Have we lost something of tremendous value in our culture? Don't forget, we are part of a Judeo-Christian culture. My answer is yes, of course. Of course. We have lost something of value. We cannot think in those terms anymore.
We cannot attain the truth about the catastrophe. Well, I don't even want to prejudge it. We cannot attain to the truth about the times in which we live.
It's very difficult, and it's becoming progressively more difficult for a very simple reason. Those in a position to know the 20th century from the inside, where the horror really lay, are dying. Which means that for historians to look at the 20th century, they will have to look at the 20th century the way we look at the Napoleonic era now. And the natural human bonds of outrage, sympathy, and horror will be sundered. And this is very alarming. it means that the whole part of the 20th century, which could have been the centerpiece for a reinterpretation of human history, is destined to disappear without a trace. The real meaning.
Now, you argue, you come close to arguing for design in science. Are you arguing for some kind of overarching design in human affairs?
I believe there must be some sort of overarching design in human affairs. Otherwise, history is a series of disconnected, rather meaningless events. But I see no evidence that history is a series of disconnected, obviously meaningless events. We can see it whenever we do small historical research. Look, there's an obvious connection between the catastrophe of the First World War, the Russian Revolution, the Russian Civil War, the development and rise of Nazism in Germany, the Holocaust. These things are not random occurrences. They have an inner logic. And if we're sensitive, we can discern the inner logic. And sometimes no great sensitivity is required. Look, it would be inconceivable to think about killing all of Europe's Jews if European civilization had not so successfully killed 9 million of its brightest and most able young men in the First World War. These are connected, coordinated events. Mm.
David, two final questions.
Yes.
Let me read to you the antiphon for Mass this very day. O wisdom of our God Most High, guiding creation with power and love, come to teach us the path of knowledge. God, guiding creation with power and love. Do you buy that?
I hope it's true.
Fair
I
enough.
Hope so.
That's a fair enough answer.
I mean, look, the real answer is I am as much part of the same intellectual culture as everyone I'm criticizing because I find it impossibly difficult to get out of it. There is no double position, being in it and looking at it from the outside. And that's a difficult position, but I think that's where we all are in the West. The Islamic world has different set of procedures, different concerns. I acknowledge that. But as anyone who came to maturity, intellectual maturity, in an academic setting and is responsive to academic standards of taste, discretion, probity, goodwill, of course, I find it very difficult to evade the sense that I'm in a straitjacket. I'm suffocating in a straitjacket. But the minute I try to remove the shackles, I get anxious too. And I think we all feel exactly that way. Mm. Exactly that way.
Last question. In The Devil's Delusion, you write, I'm just going to quote you a kind of syllogism with which you end that book. If the universe is contingent, there is no saying whether it existed forever. Maybe, maybe not. If anything might not exist, then it is reasonable to ask why it does exist. Well, why does it exist? No, I mean really. How does David Berlinski answer that question? At this stage in his life, having written that book a decade ago and having the best of times in hand?
I don't think, I hate to keep giving you evasive answers. I feel after an hour interview like that, someone like a seal slithering around a pier. But I think the honest answer is, boy, are you making a mistake if you want the sciences to answer that question. The physicists are not going to give you any help.
David Berlinski, author of The Devil's Delusion, The Deniable Darwin, and as soon as he finishes writing it, to be published next year, we feel certain, The Best of Times. David Berlinski, thank you.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure. Good questions, too.
Thank you. David, from you, very high praise. For The Wall Street Journal and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.